you know, there's no guarantees. You go with an outfitter, so I mean, yeah, I would assume, and you should assume, that if you're going outfitted, your odds are going to go up, mainly because you have all the intel and years of experience already done.
Yeah.
But I really hate the stigma that's associated with it.
I would hope everyone is doing a little research at least before they draw these tags, right? Like,
yeah,
you should know the kind of country you're going to go into to start. And if you don't, maybe I encourage these people to do that before you just, like, you know, hit that application, spend $700 on a tag or somewhere, you know? So if you're hunting one of these antelope units that's just, you're hunting state land parcels, you better find yourself a hotel or a KOA or something to call home, because, like, otherwise you're going to get dinged for sleeping in the wrong spot. You can find some awesome local information just by doing some Google searches. If you search on, I don't know how much time you spend on Rock Slide or Hunt Talk or Archery Talk or all these, it's not even that you have to, like, be the guy asking the questions, because there's so much back information now that there are threads on threads on threads.
Just go back and look at what other people have asked you.
Welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Couple things before we jump into this episode. Please, you heard me say a million times, go give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this podcast free and helps with the ratings. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. If you use our promo code John Stallone, all one word, you save 20% off on anything. And it's not just shooting bags. They do glassing pads. They're working on some other really cool stuff coming up here for the hunter, bow hunters also. So go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you're looking for a really good hunt, I have some really good opportunities for you. Hit us up on daysinthewild.com or check out my blog, johnstallone.me, and send us an email. If you're looking to do a coos deer hunt, javelina, mule deer in South Dakota, we got some opportunities in California as well. So give me a call if you're looking to do something different this year and like to get on a special hunt. Days in the Wild Outfitters. And we'll take care of you. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode.
Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today, we're talking to Jaden Bales of the Wyoming Wildlife Federation, and we are going to talk, basically, we're going to talk about, hey, I got a tag. What do I do now? You know, this is a place I've never been. I just got a tag, maybe get into a little bit of cyber scouting and just the preparation that goes in before you put boots on the ground, so to speak. What's going on, Jade?
Hey, man. Well, I'm excited to talk this stuff. I've been nerding out about it. I've got a couple tags in my pocket, and I know you do too. So this is pretty pertinent information, man. I'm excited.
Awesome. So give us a little rundown about yourself before we jump into the meat and potatoes of this.
Yeah, you bet, man. So I grew up in Northeast Oregon, hunting mule deer and Rocky Mountain elk. Just to clarify for folks, I was not a West Coaster, West Sider. But then I moved out to Wyoming. This is my fourth summer here, and I work for the Wyoming Wildlife Federation here in Lander, Wyoming. I love hunting across the West. I think I try to do at least two states a year, usually home state plus one. This year I'm going to tack in three, so I'm pretty excited. I like to apply kind of across the West, and some places I go I've never been to before. Some places, you know, I'll go put a scout trip on, and man, this time of year, it's hard to get anything done because, you know, there's a little scouting outside the back door we can be doing, but then also, like, just hitting the maps, hitting the, you know, internet research and stuff. It's taking up a bunch of time in addition to, you know, trying to get some work done for real work. So anyway, I'm real excited to hop on here with you. I've been listening to you since you were in interviews with the Masters, you know, so nice. It's cool. I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome, man. Thanks for being a long time patron.
Yeah, you bet, man.
Yeah. So, you kind of said it without saying it, but it's like the whole, it's like a season of its own, you know, the tag season, there's like a tag season, and then there's all that follows it. It's like, so it what's cool about it is, like, hunting season never ends, so to speak, you know, if you're doing it right, in my opinion, you know. But so I know you kind of developed a certain I'm gonna call it program, you know, or mm-hmm. system is probably a better way to put it. So talk to me about what's your starting point? Like, what do you? Well, let's talk about one of your tags. I mean, we can, or maybe not. I don't know. You know, probably don't want to do that because we're probably going to give away where you're going to be. But let's not do that.
No.
Let's not do that. So, I didn't think about that.
No, it's all good. So, okay, let me just first, dude, when you're talking about like, this is the season of like e-scouting and like, it's its own thing. I think that's such like a what separates people apart who get out there and, you know, usually find the success that they look for, you know, whether it's someone coming out for the first time trying to just get an elk or deer on the ground or trying to kill something real big, you know, like there's the whole spectrum. If you're not thinking about it at this time, then I think you're setting yourself up for some unwelcome surprises.
Absolutely.
When you step out on the field. Right.
Absolutely.
And actually I had this thought, I don't know. It seems like the only person who really gets away with not doing this is someone who goes outfitted. As an outfitter, would you agree with that? Or is that kind
of, yeah, well, that's what you're paying the outfitter for. Like, yeah. So, you know, people look down their nose at guys who go down. I think there's a lot of guys mm-hmm. out there that are like, oh, I'm not going outfitted. That's cheating or whatever. And mm-hmm. the reality of it is outfitting is like, for those who don't have the time. So when it really comes down to it, my hunters are still doing the hunting. You know, they're still making yep. the stalks. They're still executing the shots. They're still out there from the day to day. It's not, you know, I think sometimes outfitting gets muddied up with like canned hunt in Texas or something where you're, mm-hmm. you know, somebody throws you on a stand over a feeder and you just wait for shit to come by. But, you know, there's no guarantees. You go with an outfitter, I would assume, and you should assume that if you're going outfitted, your odds are going to go up, mainly because you have all the intel and years of experience already done.
Yeah.
But I really hate the stigma that's associated with it. And
oh, dude,
it's really frustrating to me, to be honest with you, especially since, you know, I've gone on plenty of outfitted hunts in my life, and you know, people could tell me whatever. Oh, you cheat, whatever. Go ahead, cheat. Tell me I cheat. That's fine. But I'm also an outfitter. You know, like I do the same thing for other people. So it's like mm-hmm. I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. It's a tough thing.
Oh, totally. Well, and it goes back to the whole thing of like how much do people value their time. You know, like
right.
I've been out the last two mornings I've been out, but I've been out probably half a dozen times in the last week and a half looking for bucks, like deer by my house, right? Like, I mean, this is the time when we're like, if you were to pay an outfitter, this is what they're doing, right? So whether or not I spent 3 hours this morning doing it or, you know, do that consistently throughout the summer, that's what you're putting the time into. And that's also where some of this other e-scouting and all of this like other research, internet research comes in, is like, you're just trying to, you know, trying to give yourself as much of a leg up as possible. And, you know, like a lot of guys, you know, I think they can make one trip a year, you know, to this different unit or whatever. But, and I'm happy to, so I'll just lay my cards on the table. I do this side project and I can't explain a whole lot about it until it all releases, but I do this side project and the company I work with paid for a landowner tag in Nevada. And I'm not going to get my butt over to Nevada before season. Right.
Right.
It's an October rifle hunt. Like I'm just not interested in driving out there before then because I got other stuff. I drew a sweet antelope tag actually right outside my back door, and I'm pretty excited about it. But
nice.
So I'm okay to talk about that a little bit, especially because, you know what, like I've not hunted real desert country like that often. So this is some stuff I'm learning. And you know what? And you, I'm sure you're feeling this. You're feeling the brunt of this right now. We got one of the worst drought years that we've had in a long time.
It's bad. We just had a meeting, me and my two main guides, and we're cutting the amount of people we're taking this year.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually, you know, it's funny to hear somebody say this because I hunt public land mostly, and we have some private land stuff mm-hmm. that we do, but I don't think the deer herd here in AZ is healthy right now. Last year and the year before, we had the two highest success rates we've ever seen in both the archery season and rifle season. And we've been suffering for three really bad year drought. And, you know, guys are going to hunt water and, you know, it's not that hard if you're willing to put in the time. And there's a few other things. I don't want to give away those secrets right now, but to killing them on water. And when it's a drought year, because they're tied to it, they have to go, you know? So it's one of those things where like, well, we got to be good stewards of the herd. Otherwise they're not going to be here for us to hunt ourselves or to take people hunting, you know? So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's such a good mindset, man. I like that because it's like, you know, at some level, so I'm looking for bucks right now. I found this, we saw this whitetail last year. He flirts with the public boundary just a little bit in this river bottom. This whitetail he's a big whitetail. I mean, I've got him pegged about 20 inches wide right now in June. And last year he was big, but pretty young. And I'm looking at it like, dude, if we don't find some real mature, we've got a couple mature mule deer found, but like, if we don't really find something special, might as well go kill a whitetail because they're doing well at least, you know?
Yep.
And so, yeah, I'm all aboard that. It's like, you know, and I guess that's probably the step one of whenever you draw a tag is figuring out like what the situation is on the ground, right? Like if I'm sitting here looking at my Nevada unit going like, oh, look at all this high country. It's going to be great. But then you find out there's no water for 5 miles in any direction. Like, you know, that really limits where you're going to be looking at and where you're going to be figuring out how to get into. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of that first step. And I don't know if you look at that, you know, the drought monitor, the snowpack, that kind of stuff very often. But as soon as I pull a tag, I look at like what's happening on the ground and try to figure out, you know, where things are at now and what it's looking like into the future. So,
right.
You know, it's like no weatherman is very good. But at the same time, if you're sitting here in June or early July and Nevada hasn't had much for monsoons yet, you're like, uh-oh. Like, hopefully these things really turn on or else, you know, we're going to be looking at just a couple slivers of water holes. So, you know, that's something that's usually where I start is just trying to get that base information. Where are these critters going to be at? And usually you can find that just based on, you know, looking at, you know, the drought monitor. I forget what that there's like national resources here for the drought monitor, the snowpack. And then you can also just go to your Game and Fish websites, man. They're publishing so much good stuff on there. Cause I looked up some Arizona stuff. They published some really good unit breakdown information.
Yeah. I wish they were doing it on a yearly basis for here. But yes, they do have good breakdowns, but the information is not always current.
Okay. So would you say like what changes whether or not the information's current?
Obviously, a lot of the stuff that they talk about there is, you know, it's all generalized. You know, of course, they're going to give you the boundaries and they're going to give you historical areas that are good to look in, but they don't give you like, you know, current herd population. They don't give you buck to doe ratio stuff or, you know, or bull to, bull to cow or anything like that. I mean, you could find those things in other places, but I think it would be cool if they had it, if the Game Fish put that stuff out, their information, you know, at least the information from the year before might have to be for that year or whatever, just so you have something that's a little bit more. But I do agree with you. Arizona does put more information, more units, information than most Game and Fish agencies do. So,
yeah. Do you think it's safe for me to use an example with one of the Kaibab units real quick?
Sure. Yeah, that's a tough tag to draw, and you know, it's not like you can go over to counter hunt it or anything like that. So, yeah.
Oh, totally. So yeah, you look at like 12B, man, and straight on the Game and Fish website, they say, you know, this hunt in earlier season is not intended to produce giant bucks because it's a migratory area, right? Mm-hmm. And so like if you're sitting there with an October tag in your pocket, you should take that into consideration. But then if you're one of these lucky suckers, you've got a November, you know, later later tags, and then you can kind of hone in on different parts of the unit that they kind of point out. You know, they give you exact like drainages and you know, kind of land features to go check out.
Right.
It just seems like a really underutilized resource because, you know, whenever you think about, you know, calling a biologist or calling a warden, and I think people usually like jump right to that. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to get the same honey hole that every other person calls them and asks about. You know, it's just like they can only give out so much information person to person. But, you know, if you can do your due diligence a little bit beforehand, man, you can really hone in some great tidbits of information just so you can then open it up on, you know, whatever software you use to do some e-scouting and then go from there. You know, I've been bouncing between like a whole bunch of different websites for kind of Google Earth and satellite imagery because it seems like each one shows you a little something different, but it really helps paint that picture once you get a good starting point. And, all, you know, I think that I'm on a lot of forums and stuff. And like I said, doing some research beforehand is so much more helpful before you get on any forums or before you get on any calling these guys, the biologists or wardens or whoever. Because, you know, if you go into those conversations without knowing anything, it's really hard to get a whole lot of valuable information out of it.
Right. Because, you're speaking a different language too at that point. You know, they could be like, oh, yeah, you know, Wildcat Ridge and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, what the fuck is this guy talking about? Like, I never even seen that. Like, you know, so yeah. And that being said, if you could, like, what is your first step? Like,
so I would hope, and I don't know about you, John, but I would hope everyone is doing a little research at least before they draw these tags, right? Like, you should know the kind of country you're going to go into to start, right? And if you don't, maybe I encourage these people to do that before you just like, you know, hit that application, spend $700 on a tag or somewhere, you know,
right?
Like something to consider. But so once you've done that, then I say go straight to that game and fish site and see if you can find something, you know, like we were talking about. Arizona's got these game management unit overviews. Wyoming has job completion reports.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've read through these, but
no, I have not.
And I just was bugging the game of fish the other day because I was like, God dang it, guys, you need the 2020 ones. They're not out just yet, but they should be early July is usually when they publish them. So anyway, those show, you know, your herd trends, that buck to doe ratios can kind of help you give you an idea of, you know, expectations. And then they break down what's happening in the unit, you know, talk about how the winter severity was. They talk about, you know, the habitat and what things are really important. So I, you know, just once you draw the tag, see what you can find on your game and fish website. And then, you know, the other thing is right here, they already start talking about drainage A, you know, is where we're seeing a lot of deer or whatever. You know, people usually focus on Rock Creek. And then you go in there and on your website, you know, whatever you're using, Google Earth, Base Maps, Onyx, Go Hunt. Geez, there's so many.
Right.
But then you go into there and then can hone in some information. And I think that's a good first step, you know, just get the public information that's already available before you start bugging people. Because people are usually just like, at this point in the game, whether it's someone on a forum or someone in the game and fish department, they're pretty fatigued with how many schmucks are calling them asking for good information. You know, they're like, God, not another one.
Right.
So, and it's just helpful to try to not be that guy, you know, or that gal when you're giving them a holler.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
so that's usually where I'd like to be.
What kind of questions are you asking when you get? I mean, I know some of it's going to be specific to what you've already found, but yeah.
Dude, my favorite questions are going to be related to like what things look like on the ground, right? Like, mm-hmm. I've got this Nevada tag and it's got some burns in there. You know, there's this, and this is, I haven't called this person, the game warden or the biologist or game warden here yet. There's a 2020 burn here that's in some higher country, and I'm like, that would be awesome if it has grown back some, you know, hunt the edges of that thing if it's grown back some. But if it hasn't grown back at all, and they're like, dude, it looks scorched earth. We haven't gotten an ounce of water since last, you know, January. You're like, I'm going to probably stay away from that big thing, right?
Right.
So I like asking those specific on-the-ground questions, you know. How is it? Is it real thick? Are there a lot of junipers that you can glass into? Or is it one of those things that, you know, it's really rolly and it's hard to glass, so you should just kind of focus on water and do your sitting, you know. Those kinds of things are where I start asking people. the other thing is, like, you should, I encourage everyone, when they get a hold of somebody, ask them where they send people. Where's the highest number of people going to end up being, right? Because usually they'll tell you, obviously, I mean, like, they're like, oh yeah, Rock Creek is full of folks, you know, during the season. And then you can take that information and go like, okay, well, Rock Creek is full of people. There's probably a lot of animals there, but what does Rock Creek look like that I can then find on the rest of the map that looks, you know, like similar terrain or similar habitat, and I can get away from people. You know, kind of parsing out that kind of information is usually what I like to find out from people, because those are the ones, they're on the ground, and, you know, they're not sitting behind a spotting scope every day, like, scouting for you. They're not going to tell you where a deer is at. Those folks, you know, heck, they are driving the unit most often. They're kind of spending time around the area, but they're not looking at the critters every morning, you know. They're not going to tell you, oh, I saw this great buck up, you know, on this Rock Creek. I like to use Rock Creek just because it's everywhere. Everyone's
got one. Yeah, exactly.
So, or Spring Creek. That's a good one too.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I look at it. Just ask them the questions about that someone on the ground would know. Another thing is, you know, diving into where you can camp or what's like a good place to park your rig. That's pretty important too. You know, in like Wyoming, you can't camp on state land. Right. Okay. So if you're hunting one of these antelope units, that's just, you're hunting state land parcels, you better find yourself a hotel or a KOA or something to call home. Cause like, otherwise you're going to get dinged for sleeping in the wrong spot. That's some on the ground information I think that's pretty helpful too. I hunted an antelope unit that has just like what I was talking about. And we ended up camping like way up in the national forest to go antelope hunting down on, you know, in the sage flats and stuff. So it was a haul. I would have probably just rather have not brought the camper or the camping equipment and stayed in the motel, you know. But anyway, yeah, that's the kind of stuff. I think that kind of local information just seems like it's invaluable compared to what everyone is trying to find out. Everyone's trying to find out where's the deer, where's the elk,
right?
Where's the antelope in that case, you know? And it's just, they move. There's, you know, the people you're talking to aren't going to know where there's a deer, you know. Right. Last year, someone shot this elk off of this clearing, but who knows, you know, if there's ever one there that next year, you know, it just, everything changes year to year. And so you can't really find the magic bullet when you're just talking to someone who spends time on the ground. So,
yeah. I know a couple of things that I know I like to ask is what, you know, deer, elk, whatever, what's their preferred feed in the unit. I like to ask behavioral stuff like that. It's more like on the biology level. They're probably not getting questions, so they're going to be more happy to talk to you about it. And if you know how to extract what's important out of that information, you know, you usually can do very well. So,
man, that's something that I think it could be more understated or more overstated, like just figuring out what things are using. Like, and here's kind of a question for you. I know up here in Wyoming, we've got this plant called skunkbrush sumac. Mm-hmm. And skunkbrush sumac, it seems like deer eat the crap out of skunkbrush sumac starting October 10th and on. But, you know, in June right now when I'm scouting, they're not touching that stuff. You know, they've got other forage that they're doing. I don't know. Is it similar in Arizona where they, like, you know, in your August, September season,
yeah,
they're hitting absolutely one thing and then they change?
Yeah. You know, they move from, like, there's certain times of year where they're eating on the succulents a lot. And then there's other times where they're browsing and sometimes where they're having to go for forbs and, you know, so it's here, it's tough because it's so dry all the time that they're just going to go for whatever's got the most nutritional value. So, but yes, there are definitely.
Do you see that changing for elk? I just realized, like, you know, as we're talking about this, I always think of that for deer in particular, just because they're kind of, deer seem to hone in on, you know, certain habitat types and stuff. But do you see that with elk too, or are they kind of a little bit more just escapist?
Elk are bovine, you know, they're like, they're grazers like cows. So unless you're in an area or hunting a time of year when there's a lot of snow on the ground and whatever, and they need to switch to, you know, a different food source, they're typically just going to go for the best grasses that are available. That's what I found anyway. But
which would that's probably what, that's mean what science kind of the, says. But yeah. Which would mean that kind of your more riparian or a little bit wetter areas, but not necessarily like on a water hole, right? I mean,
correct.
Especially down in your country.
No, yeah, there's barely any grass around the water. I mean, that's not entirely true, but a lot of our elk country, especially if you're talking about Ponderosa stuff up high, the fish and game and the forest or more of the forest service than fish and game, but does a really good job of clearing out the understory because of fire suppression. Mm-hmm. And as a result, a lot of grass grows in tall timber, you know, where normally if you have like a dark timber, you're not going to have stuff down on the ground. You know, it's just going to be old needles and pine needles and dried nasty shit. But because they, you know, do so much trimming and whatever, and their trees aren't really densely packed, a lot of sunlight gets to the ground and there's a lot of grass. So they don't have to go to these open parks. I mean, you'll find, obviously you're going to find them in open parks and certain times of the day, but it's not like hunting in Washington or Oregon where they're, understories like, you know, a jungle and it's just all ferns or whatever. And then they have to come out really to get really good feed. They have to come out to like a clear cut or a burn or something, you know? So
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great example, man. And I didn't think about that, but yeah, that's a, you know, especially when you're talking about just different terrain types, you got to figure out like the place you're hunting is each zone is going to be a little different. You know, I don't know if you've hunted much in Southern Utah in particular, or, you know, there's a lot of that kind of low brush and shrub and, you know, like knowing that they, you know, if they're hitting that, if they're hitting I don't know if you have like a manzanita, you know, that kind of thing where you're like, oh, dude, it is the dirtiest, nastiest brush. We had it. I lived in Bend, Oregon for a while. And that whole Central Oregon country has it so bad. I'm sure it's probably like that in some places where you can't drive your truck down a two track without coming out with less paint than when you went in, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. We have yeah. several units here in Arizona that one that's real close to my house is unit 22 and 23. And they're 23 is an amazing elk unit. 22 is used to be an amazing elk unit. There's a lot of elk there, but they've killed off all the freaking age class. So, but there's still a crap ton of elk there, but it is all oak scrub and manzanita. And it's just, I mean, you really, like when you're putting on a stalk, you really need to pick a route, like, and you're following elk trails the whole way because you just, every 10 feet, you got to stop and go a different direction. And it's tough. It's some tough shit they're hunting, but, that's why there's still a lot of elk there. Cause it's, you know, it's, it provides a certain amount of feed and cover that helps them out anyway. So,
yeah. Well, man, and you kind of brought it up there, but I, you know, one thing I haven't had a lot of luck getting information on from anyone in the game and fish department in particular is like quality of critter. You know, like they talk in so much generalities that, and this is where, you know, maybe you should move into step number two, mm-hmm. or I guess that'd be three. So you look at state published information, then you call your biologist or warden. And then you start doing some more internet sleuthing and actually talking to people on the ground. Cause those, you know, those first two resources are great. But if you want to know, like if there's 320 or 350 bulls on the ground, mm-hmm. dude, I have not found very many game and fish folks who actually are like super interested in that type of detail. You know, some will be like, yeah, there's some nice ones in there or, you know, right. But what's a nice one? You know, I know that the unit I applied for, I was talking to the biologist, just kind of part of my job. And I was asking him about, you know, what kind of critters are you finding up there? He's like, oh yeah, good 4 points and stuff. And then I talked to a buddy who had actually hunted in that unit. And he's like, here's a 195 buck. Here's a one that went 203. And I was like, oh my God, those are my the biologist here. He kind of undersold it a little bit. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those are also things. I don't know what your experience has been. I don't finding out actual expectation type information. Like it's not
something I ever ask, to be honest with you. And the reason it's not that I don't care is that I go with the mentality that, especially coming from here, let's talk about elk hunting here in Arizona. people talk about, oh, that's a shitty unit, that's not a great unit, da 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 da, that's a trophy unit. I go with the mentality that there's a 400-inch bull in every unit, you know? And if I put in the time and the effort, I'm going to come home with something that I'm happy with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But the thing that I put the most weight on is I look at the success rate. So let's just talk out, cause it's easier for me to just equate it to something. So for instance, like on Go Hunt, okay, they give you a bull to cow ratio and they show you the success rate of the unit. If that success rate is equal to the national average for bow hunting, let's say I'm going on a bow hunt. Let's say I'm just pulling arbitrary numbers out of my ass right now, but
okay.
Let's say the national average for bow hunting elk is 20%. And I look at that unit and it's got a 25% success rate on that hunt, or 20% success rate on that hunt. And the bull to cows is, you know, 50 bulls to 100 cows. In my head, I look at that and I'm like, that's the recipe I need, because...
Yep.
And this is going to sound conceited, but I know if the success rate, the average success rate is 20% or better and nationally, and the success rate for that unit is better than that or equal to it, I'm going to be successful there.
I like that, man.
But
yeah.
I know my personal success rate, you know, my personal success rate filling tags over how many years that I've been hunting. You know, I know what that is. So with that, and then I know it's a place that I could be successful in, if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes total sense. And honestly, you know, I think for someone who hunts a lot and has had good amounts of success previously, I think that seems to be like the more efficient way to think about these success rates. Cause otherwise you're just looking at success rates and shoot, you might end up in some place. You're like, gosh, that means my chances are good. When you find out that like, they're just really available, you know, you're not going to have the trophy quality that you're necessarily looking for, or just the maturity, you know, depending on whatever you're looking for. Yeah. But I guess if you're a meat hunter, maybe that's where you want to end up. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, true. Well, I mean, and I don't know. It could be a skewed thing. Like I said, here in Arizona, 2 years in a row. I mean, they just we this year they closed down in the over the counter archery. Like half the state's closed,
right?
Because they've surpassed their quota in the previous year, and now those units will be closed for 2 years.
Yeah.
So, like it might have just been one of those. You know, there was the perfect storm, quite literally. You know, it could have been high country hunt and got a bad snowstorm. All the deer came down where all the hunters were, and bang, bang, pow, pow, everybody got one. You know, who knows? But
oh, yeah, man. I'm so nervous about that happening in Colorado this year. I guess, you know, I think there's a lot of, I don't know how you feel about this. There's a lot of kind of doomsayers about the mule deer in Colorado.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say that I think that there's going to be a ton of bucks left over, but if one of those, you know, seasons hits or that storm hits just as second season's ending and third season starting, oh man, there's going to be a lot of deer killed, right? Mm-hmm. So that success rate's going to be so dang high, but it's not going to reflect very good on the older age class population the following year, as an example. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what your experience has been though. Have you any exact examples of coming in after a big winter or a big, you know, a big event the year prior and having no luck finding older age class?
Yeah, I do. And it's actually on my lease in South Dakota. Several years back, we had they have almost a bad winter every year, but they had a really, really bad winter, and we went to hunt the following year. And, you know, I typically see, I don't know, I couldn't even tell you how many deer I see a trip, but those numbers, just the overall numbers of the deer were almost cut in half. And then, several years back, Jesus, is going back a ways, probably 18 years ago, we used to go up to Idaho and hunt whitetail, believe it or not.
Up in the northern, like the panhandle type stuff?
Yeah, yep. And they got blue tongue, and, you know, I didn't find out about it until we got there back there the next year, and there was no deer anywhere, you know. So, yeah, obviously there's stuff like that that happens all the time that you got to be mindful of.
Yeah, oh, totally. Well, man, the other thing that I've noticed, like on a year-to-year basis, and this is where, you know, it's good to get as much recent information as you can, you know, whether it's, you know, too many tags given out or a bad storm or whatever, sometimes the critters just like aren't in the places where they've said they were in the past, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I had a it's funny, my girlfriend has been hunting this local area where I live for a long, like 11 years now. And last year she was like, dude, this is my favorite spot. I will show you all the bucks in the local area. Let's go check glass this spot. And last year, like, well, we turned up, you know, 4 bucks in the morning, something like that, you know, on average. Sometimes you see a few more, sometimes you see a few less, but probably on average 4 bucks in the morning. And she kept going like, gosh, dang it. Like, I have not seen the deer that I normally see. And I kept going like, well, this is a fine spot. Like, there's a mature buck in there. There's a couple up and comers. Like, I was like, this is a fine spot. Don't feel bad. She's like, no, you just haven't seen it in the way it is.
Right.
And we went out there, yesterday morning, and we counted up 14 bucks on that hillside. And she's like, this is what I was talking about, you know?
Yeah.
And there was nothing really changed. Nothing was too crazy year to year as far as the winter goes and that kind of thing. But, you know, just the difference in patterns, the difference in timing, and whatever the case was, man, there's a lot of deer hanging out on that mountain right now.
Right.
So yeah, that as much local information as you can get is really important. It kind of is like, you know, I think the way that you go about the local information though is probably the most important part, because no one's going to tell you I'll send you to this specific Spring Creek because there's my big buck up there. But
right.
Gosh, it sure seems like, I don't know how much internet sleep, and maybe I'm one of those guys who spends too much time on the interwebs, and I acknowledge that. But you can find some awesome local information just by doing some Google searches. If you search on, I don't know how much time you spend on Rock Slide or Hunt Talk or Archery Talk and all these, it's not even that you have to like be the guy asking the questions, because there's so much back information now that there are threads on threads on threads.
Just go back and look at what other people have asked you.
Yeah. And you know, that can help really lessen that learning curve a little bit, just so, you know, then you have, when you walk into your unit, whether you're scouting or it's game time, you know, you have plans A through C, A through X, you know, however many you need, and can go and actually lay down a decent plan and move through kind of more systematically, instead of being like, oh my God, this is the only place I had in mind, and now, you know, there's a camp in the middle of the basin. What do I do?
Yep.
So
yep.
Yeah, that seems to be pretty constant, you know.
Best laid plans usually blow up. So.
Oh man. Yeah. So. No, I totally feel that. Do you have any other hunts that you're really looking forward to this year that you're in the middle of this process with?
Well, yeah, I drew that Books Cliffs tag. Mm-hmm. And, so I'm in the process of working on that. I haven't, I've gotten some intel, luckily for me. This is something that we haven't talked about, but I've been a guy that's, people come to me and ask me information all the time. And I've got a lot of, equity out there in helping people achieve their goals, right? So when it comes down to me asking people for help, there's usually somebody that owes me at that point, you know? So I've had a few guys reach out that I've helped on other hunts that have had that hunt recently, give me some information. So I do have some starting points already, thank God. But like mm-hmm. you, like you said, I don't think I'm going to be able to get out and do any scouting. And plus, that hunt is one of those hunts that, unless I'm scouting the week before I go hunt, I'm probably not doing myself any good, because the deer are not where they're going to be when I get there.
Oh man. Yeah.
So yeah. It's one of those situations where like, okay, yeah, I could go up there this summer and go take a look, but those deer aren't going to be in the same areas more than likely. So
I did this last year. I drew a second choice. I drew a second choice third season tag in Colorado last year, and I kind of had that same mentality of like, I can't really like, you know, do anything, but I wanted to go check it out. I don't know how many times I'll ever go and try to pre-scout a late season hunt like that, man. It's kind of like I got there, I knew where I wanted to park, and like the logistics part was nice.
I was just saying like, that's the one thing you can. Okay, where am I going to stay? Yeah. Where am I going to get food? Where's gas at? Where's, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's that's invaluable. But you also got to weigh it against how much time and effort it takes you to get up there. I mean, this we're talking about a 9-hour drive. Yeah. You know, it's not something I could just run up for the day. I'm definitely going to have to stay, you know, a day or two. And I just don't know. I don't see where I could fit it in my schedule. I don't know. We'll see. If I do, I will.
Well, but, man, and it seems like, okay, so let's say just to figure out the logistics, you're going to spend 2 days, right? Or really, you're going to be almost like 3 days if it's a 9-hour drive, right? You got like a day to drive up, and then you want to check everything out, and then a day to drive back. And it just seems like so much easier to tack on one more day on your hunt than to do that, you know? Yeah. And that's where, you know, maybe asking the right questions of the people who live there, like really makes a difference, right? Where can I camp or whatever? And then they'll tell you, and that's where you set up, you know, and can be mobile from there. Cause I know like last year I went out to the Colorado spot and, you know what, where I set up and like where I had said in my mind, this is where I'm going. This is where I'm parking my truck, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. There were no freaking deer there because it was too snowy and they'd all migrated down lower. Right. You know, so even if I was able to get my, even though I was able to get my truck there, like, you know what, that plan was not the best plan.
Yeah. plans go out the door. I feel like I just told a story not too long ago on my podcast, but, I had drawn a, late season bull tag here, archery. And man, I had this place, I had this unit mapped out. I had tree stands up. I had mineral sites. I had water holes, cameras running everywhere. And I was like, I'm going to kill a freaking big ass bull on this hunt and prove everybody wrong that it's not a shitty hunt. And, man, I had it all dialed in, and no joke, like 3 days before the hunt, this giant snowstorm comes in and I couldn't even get to half the places, you know, that wanted to get to, you know, that I had. As a matter of fact, I had to go back there in March, I think, to go pull out my stands and my trail cameras. But it was like a mass exodus, like all the elk, and deer too, but they were dropping off the mountain. And, you know, it took me a while to figure out where they went. I ended up having a good hunt, and I didn't end up getting one. I got one the very next year, but I didn't end up getting one. It was just, it was just one of those things. Like I had this perfect plan and I had all these options, but it was all laid out on the same, you know, on the same foundation. Mm-hmm. So,
That's tough, man. Yeah. So where were you at last September, like the Labor Day last September? Do you remember? Were you in the mountains?
I was hunting with a client elk here in Arizona.
Oh, okay. So you probably didn't get the snowstorm then, did you?
No, fuck. I would have paid for a snowstorm. We were at 95 degrees and shit the whole time. It was miserable.
Oh, that's rough.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, meanwhile, in Wyoming at 10,000 feet, we got. Well, actually, we got – I still am picking up limbs, and I got some limbs in the yard that are about to come down from that storm because they – like we got, 6-8 inches at the valley floor, 5,000 feet of snow. And up in the mountains, you know, we're talking a foot, 18 inches, depending on what elevation you're at. And holy crap, did that just totally – like it wrecked our elk hunting plans. Again, like I got to give more credit, I guess, to my girlfriend, Jess, because she seems to have done all the scouting for me last year. Mm-hmm. But she was like, hey, I called a raghorn in here. I was off archery deer hunting elsewhere. And she was like, I called a raghorn in here last weekend. And we came in after that storm and we couldn't even buy an elk track, let alone find a bugle, you know,
right?
Because it just jacked everything up. And you know, like, so there were some guys up there who were up on the mountain road, and they got snowed in just like you're talking about, and we're just screwed because, you know, they didn't have a way to get out and yada yada. Obviously, that's maybe a little bit more of a freak storm, but, you know, that just goes back to that whole, like, having multiple game plans is so dang important because you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man. As far as elk hunting is concerned, though, it sure seems like you guys down in the Southwest have to contend way more with whether or not there's water and whether or not they're moving in the daylight than any sort of other game plans. I know you guys have had some fires, though. Is that screwing with you yet?
Oh, yeah. We got a really big one going on right now in one of the units that I guide in. I actually didn't draw anybody in that unit this year for elk, so I'm kind of thankful, to be honest with you.
Yes. A little blessing in disguise there. So what do you guys do? I know, you know, coming from Oregon, people always bitch about, you know, whether or not they can – get into their spot when there's a fire closure, you know, especially because all the timberland. Do you have any tips for like a fire backup plan when you're looking at these single units that you've got tags for, or are you usually pretty hosed?
No, I mean, it all depends on the fire. So I'll just use it to my advantage, you know, that the elk and deer got to go somewhere, you know, and usually the unit's large enough that hopefully the whole unit's not engulfed in flames, but just kind of come up with a plan of action. Now, obviously if your access points are all cut off, then you're kind of screwed. But I haven't had that yet, fortunately. I do know some guys that have had that situation where just every road leading into the unit, even though the whole unit wasn't shut down, but all the major roads like were basically closed, that it didn't make any sense for them to hunt.
Do they offer like tag refunds or anything like that down in Arizona?
You know what? I don't know. I really don't know. Again, because I've never had to turn one in because of that. Every time we've turned in a tag, it's before the hunt, and we do the point guard thing here now.
Yeah,
which is, it's like a double-edged sword. It's a good and bad thing. But, you know, you could turn in your tag and get your points back. And, you know, you just lose the money for the tag itself. But yeah, I don't know if there is anything. My guess is no, there's not.
Okay. Well, I know that was an issue last year in Wyoming, because there was this giant fire that called the Mullen Fire, that I think when it went into Colorado, it made it Colorado's largest fire. It wasn't Wyoming's largest fire, but it was a big son of a gun, right? Wow. And they basically, well, two things is kind of interesting. One, they shut down all of them. They allowed people to return moose tags, actually, in that area. And then they also did that for the limited quota deer in that area and had to roll those licenses over into this year. I do have a buddy who actually ended up, he kept hunting that deer unit and shot a real nice, like 170-inch buck still. So I know that, you know, a lot of people just say like, oh, there's a fire, I'm giving up. Just like what you're saying, though, it doesn't seem like it's the end all be all for every single fire, depending on how it all goes.
Right. Yeah. For the most part, you know, you just got to use it like, think of like hunting pressure, you know, you just got to use it to your advantage where the fire's at, and probably not where the deer and elk are going to be, you know? So, I mean, and that's not entirely true. They might be geographically might be there because they have really can't go anywhere else. You know, I know a couple of friends of mine that have hunted during a fire or just shortly thereafter, and you know, and done well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Even when it's just black, you know,
right?
I especially in those late seasons, I've heard that's kind of helpful, especially like a late elk season, because those bulls will be in there, or like just elk in general will be back in there because it's kind of warm. It's got like that thermal effect, you know, that from the blackness, it keeps things kind of toasty. So that's just like I don't know if that's scientific or not.
No, I don't know.
It sure seems to be.
I don't know. I haven't been faced with it enough for me to even formulate a, you know, a system to work around.
Yeah.
So, but.
Moral of the story, we should probably be looking for it this year or have fire backup plans dang, man, it's looking like it could be pretty bad.
It's going to be bad. It's going to continue to be bad too.
Yeah, for sure.
So And I got my conspiracy theories on it all, but
you should do just a conspiracy theory podcast. And I thought about it actually.
I thought about doing another podcast that was completely different from what I do now, but
that'd be funny. Just call it the conspiracy theory and just like be like, you know, the disclaimer at the front is just make sure no one holds it against you if they disagree, but just layer out there. And we'll see how it goes.
Yep, exactly. So one other question, and then I want to kind of jump into what you do for Wyoming. My brain's not working very good right now. I wrote it down. I'm trying to figure out what the hell I wrote.
We need to get you some of that. That's the stuff that.
Ginkgo biloba.
Or that stuff that Rogan talks about.
And I've heard about it, but I'm actually not a. I don't listen to Rogan's podcast.
I haven't listened to one for a long time.
I get annoyed when I listen to it for some reason. So real quick, I wanted to ask you what were some of the things that you look at? And I don't remember if we had talked about this previously or if it was during the podcast, but you know, we talked about management reports and like migration studies and stuff. What is some of the information that you're looking to extract from those?
That's a great question. I'm surprised we didn't dive into that earlier. It's one of my favorite things because to your point about what I do for work, it's something that I'm inundated with on a daily basis because we work on kind of conserving migration corridors and stuff like that. Anyway, as far as the hunting lens is concerned, man, they're, in Nevada too, Wyoming is kind of leading the charge, it seems like, with the published information on migration stuff. Colorado's got a ton of information. Any of these kind of Rocky Mountain states where there's a clear, defined high country that's not really great in the wintertime period, there's some information you can usually dig up. And on the migration atlases that are available in Wyoming, you can see this whole freaking route, right? Like they pretty well paint it out for you. And I'm going to disclaimer this. Like, look, I do understand that there's a little bit, especially from residents who have been hunting these areas, they don't like that this stuff is published. And I do agree that there's probably some downside to giving everyone the exact drainages that these deer and elk are walking down, right?
Yeah.
However,
of course.
Until, and I think what you'll see is if it makes a big difference in harvest and yada, yada, then we're going to see reduced opportunity, whatever. That's a big snowball that you can try to parse out. But regardless, we've got the information now. If we're hunting, I think it makes our experiences better. We should probably try to use it. So one of the things that I like to do is just look at where these critters are going to be moving through and also find out kind of what time frame they're going to be pumping down. I had a friend of mine who's a researcher who just published some information on this mule deer herd that comes from Colorado into Wyoming. And he studied the timing of bucks versus does. Mm-hmm. He found that, these bucks in particular, he's looking at adult bucks 3.5 years old or older. So honestly, that's probably the kind of buck I'm looking for. I'm not chasing too many deer for meat right now. I've got cow tags for that.
Exactly.
So some of that information that's been published is like showing that these deer use the terrain a little bit differently because they are a little bit bigger bodied and they have bigger stomachs. They eat woodier browse. They're not, moral of the story, they're not coming out of the mountains until, they're pushing a little bit of snow with their stomach. In particular though, this is looking at the October migration period. Mm-hmm. Something you're finding for like a second season Colorado tag or, a lot of these limited quota elk tag or deer tags in Wyoming are like that, where you're trying to time the weather a little bit. Mm-hmm. Moral of the story with that though was like, yeah, you probably should you should go high, right? If you want a bigger buck, you should try to find kind of the tail end, 1,000 to 500 feet above where the does are hanging out.
Right.
And this kind of information is stuff that, I will say if you're just wanting to go into some place and like, punch your tag or whatever, maybe you don't need to do this level of in-depth research. Mm-hmm. But if you're a fanatic, like I know that you are, you can really find some sweet information that gives you a good starting point when you're putting together like all of this information at one time. If you think about it, all of these different questions you're asking, you know, you're looking at the state published information, you're talking to biologists, you're doing some internet sleuthing on forums or blog posts or whatever. Instagram's also a good one because you can geotag, like, oh, man,
right.
This is a, anyway, I won't go into that one. You'll figure it out. You can geotag, like if you look back at geotagged photos, you'll see what other people have killed in that area usually, because especially early on, people weren't noticing that that was, anyway, it's not a great tactic for the most up-to-date information, but I like looking at what people have killed in an area, whatever.
Right.
But once you put all this information together, then you can, you know, it gives you a full picture of the place that you're going into. You know, like the migration information for this area that I have my deer tag in Nevada, it basically says, you know, these deer migrate north. And I'm like, dang it. I was camping on the south end of this mountain range and the deer come off the north side. In the mid-October, mid to late October hunt, you know, I'm going to move my campsite so that it's out there where, especially if we get weather, where it's out there where I won't have to travel 2 hours to get into the deer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are the things that I think people should be looking at as far as, you know, able to put together the research side of things, and then they can, you know, have a really good full picture of a game plan, you know, moving forward.
Right. Right.
Oh,
well, cool.
Yeah.
So let's get into the Wyoming Wildlife Federation. What do you guys do?
So, the Wyoming Wildlife Federation is the oldest sportsman's group, conservation group in the state of Wyoming. So we've kind of started in the early days. You know, people have probably heard of National Wildlife Federation. Mm-hmm. In the early days, we were tied pretty closely with that. And then now we are what you'd call, it'd be like a, not a, we're not tied to their decisions, but we are kind of like associated with their greater arm of the National Wildlife Federation.
Okay.
In particular, though, we focus a lot on policy and legislation for hunters and anglers. So a lot of that means, you know, just making sure that we can improve access, especially on the east side of the state, where access is an issue for antelope and mule deer in Wyoming. You know, last year we passed an access bill, tried to get some more what we call hunter management areas, walk-in areas for Wyoming. So yeah, the gist of it is we're the hunter's voice in policy and legislature. But really what that means is we're looking at, you know, conserving migration corridors. We're looking at ways to get more access for hunters and anglers, you know, those kinds of things that are a little bit bigger reaching as far as like making a lasting impact that's in statute or something. And then on the side of that, you know, we do have some folks, we have 9 folks, I think, that work for us now. Mm-hmm. So we do some habitat projects, we do some kids classes and stuff like that, that all just kind of support that greater mission. So awesome. No, it's been fun. I sit here and talk about mule deer and elk and antelope most of the day, every day. That's what I do as a communications guy, is spreading the information. So yeah, it's been good, man. I've been here just over a year and a half, and the other thing is there's some good flexibility. If folks haven't noticed, I have a little bit of flexibility in my fall hunting schedule. Right now we're pretty balls to the wall, you know, getting things set up for then. But then things really throttle back, and it's nice. So I guess that's one of the biggest benefits, you know, of being in working for a group that is tied to hunting, is they understand when you take a week or two off, you know.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. So yeah. how can listeners get involved in that?
Well, if you want to, the easiest thing to do is go follow us on all the social medias and get our emails at Wyoming Wildlife on Facebook and Instagram. That's where I spend most of my time disseminating information. If you go there, you'll notice one of the biggest things we're doing right now is our commissioner's tag raffle. Mm. So I thought I got cute with it and called it the refund raffle, because if you're like me and you've got some refunds coming from Wyoming's Game and Fish, maybe you can put that money into this commissioner's tag raffle. And the commissioner's tag will give you the option to hunt any deer, elk, or antelope, but you got to choose just one hunt in 2021. So we're talking stuff that doesn't have like any non-resident tags, unless you're a max point holder. Some really high end hunts that you can go win. The other thing is, I'm very happy to help folks choose units and try to get them down the path with all this education that, you know, you get from on the ground or people who live there. So everything that we've talked about, if someone actually did draw who listened to the podcast, like, I will personally help them figure out what they want to do if they don't know already. So
nice.
Yeah. And then, so that goes to support our work down at the legislature in particular. You know, just keeping that voice and resources for hunters down there. And, you know, Wyoming, we're pretty lucky. Most legislators and stuff do a little hunting and fishing themselves. So they're pretty friendly to that in general. But then also just making sure we don't screw things up today for next generations either. So that's kind of what we're working on and what that commissioner's tag supports.
Well, sweet. Well, we appreciate that.
Well, yeah, absolutely, man. I know we got to get you back up in here pretty soon. I know Point Creep killed a lot of people's hopes and dreams, but you know.
Yeah.
Maybe next year.
I haven't hunted Wyoming now. I went every year for like 5 years for deer and antelope. Sorry, javelina popped up on my screen and I'm like a freaking...
I got to get me one of those stink pigs.
Yeah, come down, man. Anytime.
That's awesome.
So I hadn't been there. Now, I know I could still draw those tags because they're basically almost over the counter, like
yeah,
where I hunt anyway. But for elk, man, the last time I drew an elk tag, that was 11, 12 years ago, something like that.
Whew.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk offline and find a way to kill those points for you next year. I don't know if you put in this year, but geez,
I shot for the stars. I went for the hardest in the state because I did not want to draw because I had a client that I drew here with an early season or early rifle elk hunt.
Oh, man.
And I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, I want to guide that, man. That's going to be awesome. It's like we super awesome unit. And no shit, this guy just canceled on me three days ago. And I'm like, you mother.
Oh, no.
Like, I'm like, man, I could have totally been. I mean, I have an Idaho tag, so I'm still going elk hunting, but
okay.
I kind of based all my stuff around this. I had an early season guy and I had a late season guy that both of them, like, oh my.
I don't know what was
going on this year, but the outfitting is. Luckily, we wanted to dial back because we didn't want to take as much, but there's some guys that we were really excited about taking, and now we're not taking them. It's kind of pissed me off, but.
Oh, that's frustrating. So. Well, I will say, I don't know when this comes out, so this may or may not help your odds, but there's still some leftover tags here in Wyoming for elk.
Right.
Maybe we can.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that off podcast. I have an idea that I wanted to do, but I'm not sure that it's feasible. But
okay, well anyway. We could talk about that offline here, man. Yeah, I'm happy to. That'd be good.
So with that said, thanks for coming on and sharing your information with us. And I think there's some good tidbits for guys out there to adapt into their skill set.
I appreciate you having me on, man. And I know, like I said, this is the podcast I've listened to for a long time. So I just... feels like an honor to be on here. So, and if anyone wants to reach out to me directly, they sure can. They can find me on all the Wyoming wildlife stuff, and I'll be happy to help them, you know, in the same conversation that we're about to have here, maybe a little different.
Yep. Awesome. All right, man. Cool. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com and be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.